The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, glory, America. England beats Germany 2-0 in the Euro Cup. I'm celebrating because they beat Germany. The third time in 100 years. Now, we're very happy about that. My grandkids are living in England, and they're at the right age to get caught up in a sweeping fury of excitement that has rippled across England, and they were all excited. Now, mind you, they're 9-7, but they really, really wanted England to win, so I'm happy about that. Meanwhile, the cover of the New York Post is my favorite story of the day. Put up the cover of the New York Post. I love this cover of the New York Post because in the city of New York, they have utterly botched you can see it if you're watching Hugh Hewitt on the YouTube channel, botched their election. And we have Democrats from the New York City to California complaining about election reform to make it easy to vote and hard to cheat. In Georgia, Arizona, and Texas, while Democrats in New York are making it easy to cheat and hard to vote in the city of New York, mayor race mayhem. And New York's mayoral board counted 135,000 test ballots. Nah, there's nothing wrong with elections in America. Nothing wrong at all. They counted 135 test ballots in the first year that they used ranked voting. And that means if your winner didn't win, you get your next favorite person. And we got to recount five times until someone gets a majority. It's a nightmare. It's stupid. It's been turned down in every sane. You have a primary system for a reason. Somebody gets the most votes. It's called first past the post. It's only worked in England for 300 years. So they, you know, why not change it in New York City? Because they're progressives and they're dummies. That's why. So it's absolute chaos. Eric Adams is sitting there saying, wait a minute, I won. Everybody knows I won. I'm facing somebody, Curtis Silva, somebody. I'm facing somebody, and then I get to replace de Blasio. And the whole city is waiting for him to replace de Blasio because de Blasio is a menace. And they can't, you know, anyone tells you that what Georgia's done is bad or Texas is, well, you know, they're not New York City. Why don't the Democrats who are complaining go fix New York City first? Wall Street Journal, New York City mayoral race, elections board to retally votes. The New York City Board of Education will redo its tally of votes in the Democratic national race after inadvertently including tens of thousands of test-run ballots in its count. Hours earlier, the board published on its website the preliminary results of ranked choice voting tabulations, showing former Sanitation Commissioner Catherine Garcia had vaulted into second place, trailing Eric Adams by fewer than 3 percentage points. Under the tabulations, election officials redistributed votes and eliminated candidates through a series of 11 rounds until only the two leading candidates remained. This showed Mr. Adams, the Brooklyn Borough president, held on to his initial lead, garnering 51.1% of the more than 920,000 votes that had been counted. Ms. Garcia had 48.9% of the votes. She surged ahead of Maya Wiley. Mr. Adams challenged the Board of Elections count on Tuesday, pointing out the large increase of voters. On the night of the primary, the board said it had tallied nearly 800,000 in-person votes. The vote just released by the Board of Elections is 100,000 plus more than the total announced on election night, Mr. Adams said in a statement. Oops! 135,000 dummy ballots inadvertently included in Tuesday's count. We don't need election reform in the United States. Not at all. Democrats are right. Leave it like it is. Meanwhile, interesting vote. Now, the Center for Disease Control assumed unto itself an emergency power to stop evictions in the United States at the height of the pandemic. We now have 180 million people vaccinated. Masks are gone everywhere but airplanes. As I said, I was in Maine this weekend, and no masks in sight, no masks anywhere except airports and on planes where they remain in place, and you'll have to wear them or you'll be escorted off the airplane. Meanwhile, the CDC extended the ban on evictions by a month, 1 month, because there's a bunch of federal aid coming that might allow, in the next month, that might allow people to make their back payment and stay in their apartment. That's their theory. They extended it on a necessity basis. Got to the Supreme Court. By a ruling of 5-4, the Supreme Court said, okay, go. I probably would have agreed with Justice Kavanaugh, who wrote, this is not constitutional, but it's 1 month. And listen, try this again and we'll knock you down. But if you're right and 1 month is going to make a difference for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, we'll let it slide. That's not really great constitutional law, but it's prudent. And prudence is a key part of wisdom in government. So I probably would have agreed with Kavanaugh. The conservatives wanted to strike it down. It's 1 month. I'm a conservative. Some of these people can't get a house after they go out. I would guarantee you that none of the nine have been to Skid Row in Los Angeles. And I have been in the last 4 months. And that's why I would have voted for it. I can't see sending people out onto the street knowing what the homeless world is like right now. I'd give them a month to get the money. I would. Not forever. It's unconstitutional. But I'd look the other way. I'd burp. You know, I'd excuse myself from the table. I'd do something to be gracious about this, to avoid adding more homeless to the street right now because it's such a nightmare. But that's just me. That's making it up, by the way. And I'd admit it. Justice Kavanaugh is making it up. It's like the strike zone, right? Dwayne, before the show, believe it or not, just complaining about the strike zone. Honestly, he's complaining about the strike zone before the show goes on. I'm trying to do show prep. And Generalissimo is muttering about the strike zone and some umpire because the Angels lost another game. And that's like not very unusual. And he's complaining about his back because he worked in the backyard. He didn't do a complete somersault into a boat like I did. No complaints from me, but Dwayne's complaining.
And you know what? No one else has either.
About what?
Done a somersault in a boat like you did.
It was perfectly executed.
Uh-huh.
It was. It was an elegant thing. Meanwhile, in South Dakota, so, I don't know what's going on with Governor Noem. I want to get her on. She's a really good governor. But yesterday, she took a huge donation from a billionaire to send her National Guard troops to the border. Look, I don't know what it cost. That money would be better spent on the Semper Fi Fund or on ACE scholarships. I have nothing to do. I make no money from these people. They're not sponsors of the show. That's why I bring them up. ACE scholarship simply finds empty private school desks of schools that are performing high and pay for kids to go to them that are otherwise locked into terrible schools. Short, simple, keep it simple, stupid kids. ACE Scholarships does that. Semper Fi Fund gets wheelchairs, adaptable trucks, things like that for wounded veterans, most of whom are missing a limb. Those two charities, you can't go wrong getting them money. Someone just sent $100,000 to the Semper Fi Fund, anonymous donor who listened to their Memorial Day program on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Thank you, anonymous donor. And honestly, billionaire in South Dakota, it would have been better to give your money to ACE Scholarships or Semper Fi Fund. And I know what you're sending a message, but that's an expensive message. Buy an ad and send the rest to someone like that. Car dealers are selling more vehicles above sticker price. The Biden inflation is here. Above sticker. Really? I know about houses. I'll talk about that next segment. But above sticker? Yes. Automakers typically set what is known as the manufacturer's suggested retail price, and I call it the dummy price. Because if you're paying for that, you're a dummy. But with inventory tight and customers clamoring for cars and trucks, auto dealers are charging more. Well, free market, the Biden inflation. Headline from the Wall Street Journal. Biden, recent retirements throw wrench into Fed's economic recovery plan. Lots of people are quitting, saying life is short. What am I doing at work? That is not a problem for Dwayne. Life is short, so he didn't come to work. The battle to break up big tech has just begun, according to the Washington Post. That's not news. Here's news. North Korea's dictator Kim warns of a, quote, grave incident in fight against the coronavirus. That's also in the Financial Times. Kim Jong-un warns of a grave incident. It must have broken through. It's bad news everywhere with the coronavirus. But in Israel, the news about the Delta variant, teenagers are soaring to the rushing to the vaccination centers. They're flocking there, according to the Times of Israel. Now, if you're a conspiracy nutter, you're wondering, if the Jews are doing it, shouldn't we be doing it? Well, you're saying to yourself, the Jews are doing it, we shouldn't be doing it. Let me advise you, if the Jewish teens are doing it, you should be doing it. Go get vaccinated. Moderna says, by the way, their vaccine works against the Delta variant. So does Pfizer, so does Johnson & Johnson. Go get vaccinated. Come back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. It's Wednesday. Thank you for joining me today. I'm joined by Matthew Continetti to begin this hour. Matthew, of course, is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Writes for any number of great publications, always great. Occasional colleague of mine on Meet the Press, occasionally everywhere on the television. Matthew, how are you this morning?
I'm well, Hugh. Thanks for having me.
I want to go back to your commentary piece of 2 weeks ago about Joe Manchin. And talk about what happened with President Biden's double cross. First, let's summarize your take on Manchin's op-ed in the Post 2 weeks ago.
Sure. Well, I was really writing about Manchin's position on the filibuster. And I was so amused, Hugh, that despite Manchin saying over and over and over again that he wasn't going to get rid of the filibuster, the press, the pack of wolves here in Washington, D.C., would be following him around, constantly asking. And so I talked about how Manchin is really a maverick in many ways. He's a maverick against his own party on this issue in particular. It's the only way. He's the only Democrat who can win in deep, deep red West Virginia. And yet, unlike other mavericks, say the late Senator John McCain, the press can't forgive him for it.
That is, to me, one of the great observations in plain sight. You found the purloined letter, the treatment of John McCain versus the treatment of Joe Manchin. And they are not the same, because one of those things is not the same. One of them hurts the Democrats and one of them helped the Democrats. So John McCain's famous thumb down applauded. His maverick status was greatly glorified. Joe Manchin is condemned. Now along comes bipartisan deal that lasts 2 hours. And then President Biden undoes it. Now, I've seen that misrepresented widely in mainstream media. What would you describe as the typical mainstream media reaction to the Republican position post the Biden default?
Sure. After Biden made that ridiculous comment last Thursday, the White House and the press kind of swung into action here, and they said, well, Republicans, everyone knew that the two bills were going to be tied together, that you couldn't have the bipartisan infrastructure deal without the $6 trillion reconciliation package that Bernie Sanders is prepping in the Senate Budget Committee. Everybody knew that. You know, why are Republicans being so upset? Republicans should recognize this is the way things were always going to be done. The truth is that did not work. That spin did not work, Hugh. And the evidence that the spin didn't work was Biden's, well, at least it came out under his name, statement late Saturday afternoon, that multi-paragraph statement basically tiptoeing away from the idea that if they don't pass the big reconciliation package, he would veto the bipartisan infrastructure deal.
Yep. Strike one was his initial reaction. Strike two was Nancy Pelosi saying that she agreed with Biden's initial reaction. Strike three was the walk back. So now we have to ask, where are we? Because it was clearly not what everyone understood. The media fell right in line, like Ben Rhodes's echo chamber was still there. All the instruments were tuned up and everyone began to play the same chorus. Republicans shouldn't be outraged. It's faux outrage. It's made up. They have no reason to be upset. Now we're into phase four, which is clean up on aisle three. It's not going to work. And yesterday's interview with Tim Scott that I conducted, for the benefit of the audience, you can go read the transcript at HughHewitt.com or listen to it. It's really not going to work because Republicans, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. There are backwards. Shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. We're not going to be fooled twice. And is that a reasonable position to take, Matt, at this point?
Oh, I think it is for Republicans, you know, to oppose everything and just say, look, this is a ridiculous agenda. Not only are you spending on things that aren't typically infrastructure, but you're also messing with the tax code and the 2017 tax reform, which most people, you know, I mean, has benefited the economy. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And also some of the ways that Biden wants to mess with the tax code, including, as you've been pointing out again and again, Hugh, stepped up basis, which would really kind of revolutionize the way that we tax capital gains and estates in this country. That should just be opposed outright. But for the key senators who backed the bipartisan infrastructure deal, and I'm talking the Portmans, the Romneys, the Collins, and I think Biden's statement kept them in line for now. The real worry, and I think what's behind all of this, all of Biden's gaffes and all of the different spins that they've tried out over the course of the past few days, has been driven by Biden's continued appeasement of the left wing of his party. You know, when you place the socialist in charge of the budget, which is what the Senate Democrats have done by having Bernie Sanders in charge of the budget committee, you're going to get socialist-type policies, $6 trillion in this reconciliation plan he's planning, which includes, by the way, things that have nothing to do with taxes and spending, stuff like the PRO Act, which would nullify state right-to-work laws. About half the country have these right-to-work laws that allow you to join a job without having to join a union. Well, you know, Comrade Sanders would get rid of that in this reconciliation package. Biden is worried that this new energized left is going to sink not only the bipartisan deal, but also any reconciliation package. And that's why he made his threat last week. And that's why they're really walking on the tiptoes in the White House, worried that they'd either scare away the moderates or they'd anger AOC and Bernie Sanders and sink the package from the left.
Yesterday, Mike Rogers and Tim Scott said that this whole package is doomed, both the bipartisan compromise and any reconciliation. Nevertheless, if I were the Republicans, I want to float my idea past you, because normally if you put Romney, Collins and Portman together on a piece of legislation, they have triangulated Hugh Hewitt completely. I will go along with that. Those are my three policy preference Republicans. But I listen to the politics of Mitch McConnell. So to policy those three, whatever Mitch wants to do, I'm good with. If I were the leader, I'd go out and say, we will await the House version of the Republican-Biden compromise. When they pass that and send it over, if it's what we agreed to in the White House, we will pass that and send it to the president unchanged. If they don't send it to us, it will not pass. That puts all the weight on the Democrats to pass the compromise. I wouldn't take it up in the Senate. I would say to the House, send us, you know, Joe Biden knows what's in it. He had note takers in the room. We made a deal. Biden send that to Speaker Pelosi. If she passes it with Republican votes and sends it to the Senate, we will pass that. But it's got to come before reconciliation, because the assumption always was reconciliation stood no chance with Manchin, Sinema, Hassan, and others, and that would be the breakwater. And that's what the media won't report. What do you think of my timing and my suggestion, Matt?
That's an interesting scenario. I mean, I'm, as much as I might agree with it, I know that Pelosi would reject it outright, and then you'd be in a situation where the two chambers are in an absolute standoff. I think one reason the press continues to get this story wrong is they believe that somehow – they believe they're high on their own supply. They think that Joe Biden won this 1932-level landslide, this 1964-level Democratic landslide, and he's coming in there, and he's the new heir of the New Deal and the Great Society, and he's operating with the huge 2-to-1 margins that the Democrats enjoyed in those two earlier periods. That's just not the case. As Biden has admitted, he has an effective 4-seat majority in the House. The Senate is tied, and that's created this bizarre situation where Bernie Sanders is tweeting out, you know, we need transformative change now, all capital letters, N-O-W. And you can't get anything done because the votes simply aren't there. So the one path they have, I really do believe, is somehow getting this bipartisan deal through with the 60-plus vote, having the House do it, and then appeasing not the left but Manchin, and getting him somewhere down to about $2.5 trillion. He said $2 trillion on Sunday with the rest of the package. and that passes on a party line vote. That's the best scenario for this White House, and it happens sometime, I think, in September.
If the, not, the best scenario for McConnell.
Flat. He falls flat on his face.
The best scenario for the Republicans, though, is for McConnell to say, we don't trust you. Pass it from the House. Send us something from the House and we'll pass it here, but we're not going to do this. We're not going to send over and let you hold it hostage. She held hostage the impeachment vote, remember? She is a hostage taker, Matt. There's just no way we should trust Democrats on anything. We being Republicans, McConnell ought to say, tried that, been there, done that. And by the way, Romney and Collins and Portman ought to be behind him. They got burned. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And those three know what's going on. And last quick comment, Mike Rogers on this show yesterday said, the Democratic left is to the Democratic majority what the Freedom Caucus was to the Ryan majority. Do you see that reported anywhere, Matt Continente?
I don't, but it's an absolutely accurate analogy. And because, you know, the thing with the activists is that they can never take yes for an answer. And so you would think $2 trillion would be plenty. But no, the far left wants all $6 trillion. And that could sink the package in the end.
It will. I hope it will. I think it should. If you betray people, you don't get to pull a Benedict Arnold twice. Continente, thank you. Follow him on Twitter at Continente. I'll be right back. America on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I have no idea what that is. That's the craziest music I've ever heard. Welcome back. I'm Hugh. That's just a terrible intro to Brian Westbury. He's the best economist I know. You see him on CNBC all the time. He's with First Trust Portfolio. He likes good music. That's not Brian Westbury music. Car dealers are selling, Brian, more vehicles above sticker price. That's the lead story in the Wall Street Journal today. The sticker price on cars isn't sticking. It's going up. Customers are clamoring for cars, and so the first time in my lifetime, people are walking onto lots, and the dealer is saying, you got to pay more than the sticker price on the car. Have you ever paid more for a sticker than a sticker price on a car, Brian Westbury?
No, never. One of the most amazing things that we learned, and I wish we hadn't learned it, but is how sensitive the supply chain is in a market-based economy. Now, the U.S. is not a free market completely. We have a big government, but we really have a market-based economy. And if you think of the millions and millions, maybe billions of pieces of information that go in to produce everything, to put a tomato in a grocery store, a semiconductor in an automobile, any of these things, once you turn that off, and that's what we did last year in the early stages of the pandemic, once you turn that off, you cause cascading problems throughout the whole system. And so, and then on top of it, the Federal Reserve printed money, gave that money to the government. The government then gave it to people to spend. So we had all of this spending coming in from borrowing from the future into a supply chain that was wrecked because we shut it down. And so what we have now is shortages. People have money burning a hole in their pocket, and at the same time, we can't produce enough for them to buy. And so we end up with this crazy situation where people do pay more. I don't know why. Maybe if you took advantage of high used car prices and sold your car, you need a new one at that point. It's the same problem we have with houses, right? Housing prices are up. If you sell, you have to buy a new house, but you're going to pay a higher price for that. So it's kind of a catch-22 for consumers.
Yeah, you can't downsize in a rising tide. Brian, no. Hopefully you and I, we're trying to get the final details worked out on this in Atlanta, are going to go down to Atlanta. And I was talking yesterday about if Westbury and I can pull this together, I want to call it the Biden inflation surviving to 2022. And my question to you is, the Biden people are saying this is passing. Jerome Powell says, oh, don't worry about it. This is passing. Do you think it's passing inflation or is it serious inflation?
This is serious inflation. The Federal Reserve
Since February of 2020, so that's pre-pandemic, so we have to compare everything to today, has increased the amount of dollars circulating in the United States by 30%. So the only way not to get inflation is to increase output by 30%. And I mean a 30%, one-third larger of an economy in terms of production from compared to February 2020. And there's no way we're going to do that. That's 10 years worth of growth that they have increased the money supply for in the past 15 months. And so you have to end up with inflation. This reminds me of Arthur Burns. It reminds me of the 1970s. All during the 1970s, they were the Fed convinced the Nixon administration, every administration, that, oh, no, inflation's not coming from us printing too much money. It's a structural change in the economy. We aren't going to have inflation. And so the bottom line is that you can't print 30% more money and not have inflation.
Brian, I got a quick question. Quick question for you.
Yep.
You and I have done this event twice. We've done it in Sacramento and L.A., and you bring your slide deck, and it's sold out both times. And I mean, because people want to know what to do with their money. They just love to come in here, Brian. I ask them a couple of dummy questions because I'm the average consumer, and then Brian educates the audience. So we might be doing this in Atlanta. And the key question, how long is the slide deck? I got to do a rundown for Atlanta. How long is your slide? When you do take the stage
right
by yourself.
Right now, my slide deck is only about six slides. That's all you need. All you need to know how much money they're printing, how much money they're spending, where inflation is, and whether the stock market is undervalued or overvalued.
Now, Brian, that's not a show. I need you to talk for at least 30 minutes.
Oh, well, I can turn one slide into 30 minutes.
Okay, good. That's what I, you know, if I give you 45 minutes, you can fill that, right? Because I told people,
yeah.
I told people, I think Brian spoke for an hour, but I could get him down for 45 minutes. I'm working with radio people. Everybody wants a rundown. Nobody likes to run their show the way I run my show, which is we'll see what happens. Westbury, we'll see what happens. Follow him at Westbury. I hope we're coming to Atlanta, because then you'll know what to do with your money, because Westbury is a wizard. Don't go anywhere, America. We're going to talk more about this. The Biden inflation is here. It's a nightmare. Brian is not, though. He's a wizard. Stay tuned. I am Hugh Hewitt. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm laughing because Michael Shear is my guest, New York Times, head of the White House coverage, part of their team. Michael, I never watch Russia TV, RT TV. Do you ever watch it?
I see clips sometimes when people post them on Twitter. Other than that, no.
All right. I'm going to play it in the next segment. They got a five-year-old chess prodigy, and he's sitting down on a game show. He's going to play a game with the host, and the host says to him, I got a surprise for you. I can't play chess. Here's Anatoly Karpov, 12-time world champion. The kid starts to cry and says, Mommy.
That's pretty funny.
It's, you know, even if it's RT and it's a propaganda arm of the gangster in the Kremlin, it's still pretty damn funny. All right, Michael, good morning to you. Happy 4th of July in advance. Question for you. I have watched, we have played a lot of clips of Democrats from Pete Buttigieg to AOC trying to explain what's going to happen next with the quote bipartisan infrastructure bill, which is dead in a ditch. And the Bernie Sanders imagination reconciliation bill, which is off the track somewhere in the counting room for the New York mayoral race. So what do you think's going to happen between these two bills?
I think it's up in the air. I think, as you say, I'm not sure that I would agree that, that the quote unquote bipartisan one is dead yet. But I think this is really tricky for Biden, because to the extent that he satisfies the concerns of the sort of so-called moderate senators, either in the Democratic Party or the moderate Republicans, he angers, I was going to use a different word, but he angers the left. And the more he accommodates the left, he angers the moderate. And, you know, you saw the dynamic with Senator Bernie Sanders wanting $6 trillion, I think, in the big, you know, and then immediately Senator Manchin from West Virginia says, absolutely not. We're not doing $6 trillion. And so, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I hate to sort of predict. It's possible that you know, that some way, somehow, some combination of these two bills will both get to the president's desk in a couple of months. But I think it's going to be tricky.
I suggested to Matt Cotton-Henny in the last hour that if I were Leader McConnell, I'd get Senators Collins, Romney, and Portman on flanking me. And I'd come out and say, the president knows what we agreed to. So he can go tell Nancy Pelosi what we agreed to. And if they pass that bill and send it over, we'll sign it. And we'll vote it through and send it to his desk. And just put the burden on them and de-link it or put the blame on him, because he's the guy that pulled the bait and switch. And it's not, I saw a lot of your colleagues, not you, not just the Times, but a lot of people saying the Republicans, of course, knew what the linkage was. Of course, they knew that the Democrats would do that. No, they didn't. You know, I've talked to the Republicans. They thought they were going to pass this bill and then the reconciliation would fall apart on its own because of the Sanders Manchin split. So I'd walk away from this disaster. But you really don't think it's dead?
Well, I don't. I mean, I don't just because every time in the past that I've predicted things like this, you know, something happens to make whatever my prediction was completely wrong. So, you know, it's hard to say. I think, you know, right now, Nancy Pelosi has the ability to hold the thing up. And in some ways, the president can kind of hide behind that. And, you know, the question is, how much do the moderate Republicans want? How much do Republicans want some kind of accomplishment, some kind of bill that spends some of this money to put their name behind? I mean, do some of these Republicans want to be able to say that they've, you know, that their name is attached to some of these projects that are going to be in their states or their districts? You know, if enough of them really want that, then it, you know, potentially it's possible that, you know, that some kind of version of this bipartisan spending plan passes. But again, I think it's going to be very tricky, and I don't know exactly how the president keeps all the, I mean, to use a metaphor, keeps all the spinning plates in the air without all of them falling down and crashing to the ground.
Well, Michael, John Cleese wanted a parrot. And the parrot was dead. And so that's what I think we've got here. The parrot is dead. And you're standing there. I don't know who played the other person in that. You know what you're saying? Well,
yeah.
He's stunned. It's numb. He's asleep. No, the parrot is dead.
Right. It's possible. It's possible. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying I don't know. And I think, What I will say, and what I, you know, think it's perfect.
I can't get that out of my mind now, Michael. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's your fault, not mine. But I do think that there's no way that they're going to get the kind of money that and spending that the left wants. That I will, you know, go on a limb for. I don't. I mean, it's almost impossible to see, you know, anything like $3, $4, $5, $6 trillion. You know, what is going to come is going to be much closer if it passes, you know, the so-called family plan. If that passes, it'll be much, much pared down because the power right now in the Democratic Party in the Senate is Manchin and Sinema and those folks. There's just no way I can see getting past that.
Now, okay. I'll play the parrot in the next segment for for people under the age of 30 who have no idea what Michael and I are talking about. Do your sons, would they get that? Would your kids get it? My kids would get
no.
It, but I made them watch Monty Python.
My daughter might. My daughter is a film studies person who is now, I just think, just passed her 600th movie that she's watched. So she would get it. My son would have no idea.
She could repeat the Holy Grail, the French in the
right.
castle. She could do
yes,
that.
Exactly.
So the key is, how do the Republicans pronounce last rites on this? And I think the way to do it is simply to, no matter what Beltway opinion is, the American people know a double cross, and Biden double crossed them within 2 hours, and he's walking it back. So they've done like three tries at this. Wouldn't the best thing be for the president to come out and say, I shouldn't have said that. I screwed the pooch. I'm sorry. Come back with little Black Sheba. That's one of the 600. Come back and let's try it again.
Well, I think, I mean, I wasn't privy, obviously, to the conversations. I think essentially that's what he did in private to all of the, to the Mitt Romneys and to the Collinses and to the Portmans. I think my guess is that those conversations were much more direct than the public statement that we got, and it was much more like, oh geez, I really screwed this up. I'm so sorry. Come back. Don't go away. We can still do this. They didn't quite say that in the statement, though. I will tell you that the story that I wrote and the stories that I read in other papers, you know, pretty much said that on Saturday after he issued that statement. It pretty much said he screwed up. He said, you know, he said the quiet part out loud, and now he's coming back and, you know, trying to play cleanup. So I think, the question is, do the Republicans want to walk away from it? And if they do, then it's, as you say, the parrot is dead.
In between. So great. In between. By the way, the timing of that was perfect because you said it was dead twice. That's why I just couldn't resist. But in between the meeting, the double cross and the Saturday story, Nancy Pelosi, in the least remarked upon but critical moment, agreed with the president publicly that they were linked. She has not walked that back yet, correct?
No, that is correct. And look, remember, the timing of this is important. On Thursday, I think it was, before the deal was announced, before the president, you know, sort of screwed things up, Chuck Schumer had already gone to the floor of the Senate around 10 a.m. that morning, had already gone to the floor of the Senate and talked about how they were late and talked about how, this is the left and the left is going to get what they want. They were placating the left at that point. And so, you know, whatever the president said out loud, whatever the president is now apologizing for, I think the folks in on the Hill, the Democrats on the Hill, are determined to try to continue that strategy of linking them. And, you know, and I don't know that it's going to work.
Michael Scheer, as always, a great pleasure. Follow him at Scheer M. Have a wonderful 4th of July, Michael. We will talk again soon. Scheer M on Twitter, S-H-E-A-R-M on Twitter. 600 movies. She's going to catch my first year of movie watching very, very soon. I cannot wait to be fully back in the swing of theater things. When we come back, I'll go dig up the Monty Python bit so you folks can hear it. My gosh, that was a perfect setup. Michael and I don't work together often, but that was just perfect. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to The Hugh Hewitt Show. Well, here it's fine. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Congressman Dan Crenshaw. Good morning, Congressman. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Good to be with you.
Thank you. I want to ask you about your hotline for critical race theory complaints. But first, yesterday you said Gwen Berry, who finished third, I believe, in the hammer throw and did not want to face the American flag when it went up at the trials, ought to be tossed off the Olympic team. Did you notice she was wearing a Puma shirt?
I didn't notice.
Yeah, Puma makes about a quarter to a half of their material in China. Before we kick her off, do you want her to talk about China and what they're doing with their slave labor?
Well, Hugh, you can't presuppose that these activist athletes really know much about their own activism and the contradictions that they fall into, you know. So that would be raising the expectations a little too high. I thought it was kind of funny how I became the face of this entire thing. I just answered what I thought was just a regular question on Fox and pointed out what I thought was pretty obvious. If you're going to represent the Team USA, you should like the USA. and that there's the mere notion of supporting the United States that you shouldn't offend you. But if you're going to be on Team USA, after all, you know, I think a lot of people agree with that. But next thing I know, I was trending on Twitter. And it's funny these days what will trigger the left meltdown. And it seems like patriotism to them means tearing down your country. I mean, it really has gotten to that. I don't think that's an overstatement. I don't think I'm throwing out red meat here. I think that seems to just be true. And Jen Psaki essentially said that, defending Glenn Beery. She said, you know, I can't think of anything more patriotic than protesting against our country. And not something our country is doing, mind you, just the country in general. It's like we love the country so much that we want to completely revolutionize and change it. That's sort of how the left feels about their country. It's like, could you imagine telling your wife that? I just love you so much. I just want everything about you to be different, though.
Yep.
I mean, would that be love, or would that be some kind of sadistic sort of relationship?
Now, I know what they're going to do next. They're going to suggest that you are Joe McCarthy, reborn with an eye patch from Texas, and whatever the merits of your military record and your heroism, you're still Joe McCarthy, tail gunner Joe, because you want to give litmus tests on patriotism to athletes, to which you will respond what, Dan Crenshaw?
Yeah, you know, and they also accuse me of, this is cancel culture, Dan. I thought you were against cancel culture, but aren't you doing cancel culture now? And I would say, no, look, this is a pretty reasonable discussion about standards of behavior. I mean, if an Astros player stepped onto the field wearing a Yankees outfit, there'd be a problem, right? They'd say, hey, you can't play. And again, so you're representing Team USA. You're not representing the Lakers. You're representing Team USA. So I think a small standards of behavior, such as standing for the anthem, just according to the rules, are perfectly in line with expectations. And why isn't it cancel culture? And this is actually a really good topic to hit, because even I think conservatives get this wrong a lot too. I think everybody gets it wrong. So we've got to define cancel culture properly. Cancel culture is bypassing normal debate by beating somebody over the head with some kind of accusation. Okay, so that's cancel culture, and it happens over something that is generally unintentional, maybe a bad joke, maybe a past comment that's taken out of context, maybe just a slip of the tongue, or over something that, you know, is traditionally okay, but is now not okay according to the woke left, right? And they desire to cancel you over it. So it's usually something that really shouldn't be that controversial that is controversial now. Now, why isn't this cancel culture? Because this person deliberately stepped into the fray. Like, she deliberately tried to make a skeptical of herself. Now, and of course, claimed that it was an ambush, which I thought was just a hilarious explanation from Glenn Beery, that this anthem just unexpectedly played, like, which is, of course,
I didn't hear that. Did she really say that?
Yeah, that's 100% true. Yep. Claimed that it unexpectedly played, and she felt ambushed. She felt ambushed by her own national anthem.
She's never watched an award ceremony before. Every Olympics, it's always the same. They play the anthem of the people standing on the platform. Now, if I'm wrong about that, I will be corrected. But I generally believe that is an expectation that is sort of built in to the process.
You'd be right. You'd be right. Everybody else seemed to be ready for it. You know, congratulations to our first and second place winners. Those two women, you know, deserved to win, and they were proud of their country, which is, look, the vast majority of athletes, let's be honest, the vast majority of them. But there's these select few that love to get attention and then claim to be victims after they deliberately got their attention. So, it's a very dishonest form of activism as well. They want it to seem like it's very organic and just in the moment, but it's really not. You know, she had a shirt with her that activist athlete.
Let me try and elaborate on your definition. Cancel culture is reactive to a unintentional entry into a controversial area that is punished by cancellation. Controversy attaches itself to controversial actions, and blowback from controversial actions knowingly undertaken is not cancel culture. Have I restated that fairly?
Yeah, yeah. You should write for Webster's. Those are very well articulated.
Well, it's actually just the New York Times v. Sullivan definition on who's a public figure. And if you're living in the fray, you can't be slandered. No one can slander Dan Crenshaw or Hugh Hewitt because we intentionally enter the fray. But if you're a private citizen, the slander standard changes. Defamation and libel changes for people who are not public figures. If you're a public figure, you entered the fray. And if people throw verbal kitchen sinks at you, don't cry. And if you're going to enter into the controversy, don't cry that people say you shouldn't be on the team. But if you happen to say something or they dredge up your old comment, that's appropriate. Now, let's move on to, and by the way, this will play out. You'll be on the Sunday shows talking about this, Dan Crenshaw. So get it up. Get your game on and be ready to go on. Let me ask you about your hotline. With this proviso, critical race theory is a subset of critical legal theory. Critical legal theory has been around since the late 70s, and I went to law school in the 80s, and people mocked it then as critical legal theory as being completely incomprehensible. We now know critical race theory when we see it, but we just don't understand what we're supposed to do about it. What do your whistleblower tell you that they're finding, and what ought we to do about it?
So what we're finding is in all of these sort of diversity and inclusion and equal opportunity training sessions that you're seeing throughout the military, you're seeing the principles of CRT laid out into practice. And that's what's troubling. And this manifests. So let's talk about what CRT is, right? It's this idea that there's this sort of secret racism inherent in all of our institutions. It is defined as challenging the liberal order, the liberal definitions of equality and justice, which just means equality and justice. Now, it does this in favor of basically favoring some form of discrimination in order to correct for past discrimination. That's the Ibram X. Kendi quote. And guess who's on the CNO's, the Chief of Naval Operations Leadership Reading List? Ibram X. Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist. So anti-racism thought is derived from the principles of CRT, which just assumes that all institutions are racist. And if you can't see it, it's just proof of your privilege. So there's no way to escape it from them. And then when you see it in these silly little exercises that our military folks are doing, and they are basically silly, but when you see them manifest throughout, and we get hundreds and hundreds of complaints that are related to this, and we get a lot of corroborating evidence, it starts to seem like a problem. So when troops are doing privilege walks and told to, take one step forward if you're white, take another step forward if you're male, and then, divide each other up that way. You have another case where they're supposed to wear personal identification badges and walk around talking to each other with these badges on, and these badges indicate your race, your gender, your socioeconomic class, things like that. So again, the entire point being to drive people apart into subsets of identity groups. Another strange piece of reading was, white privilege, unpacking the knapsack or something like that. And it's just a whole manual from the 80s on your white privilege and how much better better you have it. So it's just this, it's anti-racism training, but it's mostly just racist training because, if you just switch, generally speaking, if you can switch out the word white for black and it doesn't sound good, whatever you're doing, it sounds kind of racist. That's because it was always racist. There was a seminar at West Point, and this is what Mike Waltz questioned Secretary of Defense on, and this is what General Milley blew up over. There was a seminar called Whiteness and White Rage, and it was taught by a lady who has long held beliefs that the Republican Party is a white supremacist party, that the institutions of America are based on white supremacy. So this is not some thoughtful educator, okay? As Milley was implying that this was all just for situational awareness, and everybody should learn different ideas. Sorry, no, this is propaganda, and it's not as if this was being debated, okay? It's not as if there was two people on the stage debating. And, that would actually be an educational thing to see. But that's not what's happening here. So I directly refute the comments that he made on this.
But and Commander Dan Crenshaw, you're a SEAL. Waltz is a Green Beret. I got to ask before I run out of time. On your three deployments to Afghanistan, was race ever an issue among the platoons you led?
No, absolutely not. And the military is one of the most diverse and inclusive places in the country. And the reason it is because our system is designed to be so colorblind. We wear the same uniform. We go through the same training. We speak the same language. We get inculcated with the same culture. That's what inclusion actually is. And it's really important for mission success.
That is, on that note, I'm going to leave it. That's just perfect. That's what inclusion really is. By the way, that's also what the Constitution mandates state action do, which is never, ever be race conscious. Congressman, thank you. Have a great 4th of July. Good luck in round 4 and 5 with Gwen Berry. You're right. Understanding cancel culture is the secret to unlocking that one. I look forward to seeing you on the Sunday shows, as I'm sure everyone will want to book you again because of your, again, rather common sense approach to obvious problem solving. In the meantime, don't forget relieffactor.com. All right? Don't go on your 4th of July long weekend early without it. Don't go exercising this morning without it. Don't go anywhere without it. You want relieffactor.com in your life. You really do. You want relieffactor.com in your life. $19.95. By the way, we will post the audio and transcript of Congressman Crenshaw. I know you want it. We'll get it up. Always refreshing to have someone speak candidly to you about a controversial issue in which they are involved. I love them for that. The rifle coming up, but Relief Factor, between now and then, go get it, go take it, get started, join the tens of thousands of people who take it every single day. ReliefFactor.com, Andrew Biggio next, The Rifle on The Hugh Hewitt Show.